Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Hi all, Anne, great to see you. Thanks for coming. And Jean, maybe, have you been to a Sunday before? Welcome to Sunday. Yeah. Today is the, we celebrate the death of the Buddha. We do death days, typically not birthdays, in the Buddhist tradition. Because we're not afraid of death, and but somehow when I chose this, what to talk about today, I didn't choose to tell. I'm not going to talk about the Buddha's death, which I normally do. There's some great stories around the Buddha's death, but I thought I would take a koan that involves the Buddha. That koan is called A Non-Buddhist Questions the Buddha. It's case number 32 in the Mumin Khan, and I'm going to read it to you now. I'm just going to read the case. All these koans, they have a case, and then they have a commentary on the case, and then they have a poem at the end. But I'm just going to deal with the case today. A non-Buddhist in all earnestness asked the world-honored one, that's the Buddha, I do not ask about words, I do not ask about no words. The world-honored one just sat still. The non-Buddhist praised him, saying, the world-honored one, in his great benevolence and great mercy, has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way. Then, bowing, he took his leave. Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, asked Buddha, what did the non-Buddhist realize that made him praise you so much? The world-honored one replied, he is just like a fine horse that runs even at the shadow of a whip. That's it. So this non-Buddhist comes to the Buddha with a deep question. A question that I think shows that he has, in fact, already sorted some things through. I mean, it's not even a question, really. He just says, I do not ask about words, I do not ask about no words. So already he knows that words and no words are important, are an important part of this practice, and important. So he has this question about how do words and no words fit in together. This thing never happened, you know, by the way, with the Buddha. This is not an old sutta. This is a newer Zen spin on something that may have happened. But it's instructive. It tells us about the Zen way. So it's possible that this probably was a Brahmin or something like that. There's one translation that says a non-Buddhist philosopher questions the Buddha. So maybe a philosopher of some sort. But I think the first thing that this koan tells us, or one thing that it tells us, is that a non-Buddhist can get it. You don't have to be a Buddhist who has trained for many, many years in Buddhism to get this. And it says here, you've enabled me to enter the way. In another one it says, you know, I've awakened. I got it. Or I've had a big experience, you know, just watching you sit there. So, and not only can a non-Buddhist get it just as much as a non-Buddhist in this story can be brighter than the Buddha's disciple. The Buddha's disciple heard the question, saw the answer, Ananda was like, what was that all about? What did he see that I didn't see? So that is something that we, I think, all can stand to remember, that we Buddhists don't have a patent on deep wisdom, that Zen is a tool to get to an understanding of the world, to see the world differently, but it's only a tool. It said Zen is a finger pointing at the moon. When you find the moon, you don't need the finger anymore. Don't be attached to Zen. Don't be attached to Buddhism. There are other ways to, another one from Ikkyu. Many paths go up the mountain. One moon grazes the top. So that's an important thing to remember, I think. As I said, he doesn't really ask as much as he says, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for no words, and the Buddha just sits there. So we're going to get to words and no words in a minute, but I thought what I'd like to do is first point out that this guy has a little awakening, or has an awakening of some sort, and the Buddha's attendant, Ananda, does not have an awakening. And the Buddha says, when he's asked by Ananda, he says, let me say something about Ananda first. He was kind of famously slow in the awakening department. He had a very good memory, and he was a great chap. He was the Buddha's attendant. He was around him more than anybody. He was there when he died. He was there. He went on solo retreat with him just before he died, just the two of them. So he knew the Buddha well. But unlike some others, like Shariputra or Subhuti, he did not have a great awakening in the Buddha's lifetime. That came after the Buddha had died, in fact, according to the tradition. So he also had a great memory for what the Buddha said. He was famous for that. So it's thanks to him, partly thanks to him, that all of this stuff got passed down, all of these stories about the Buddha. But the Buddha tells Ananda that a high-class horse runs just, a fine horse, runs just at the shadow of a whip. So, this non-Buddhist, he was a fine horse. What does that say about Ananda? Good students are quick. Now that refers to, now we're going to get to the Buddha, a little, canonical story from the Buddha. Because that, the shadow of a whip, refers to an old sutra in which the Buddha says this. He lists four kinds of practitioners. And he kind of ranks them, or that's the way it looks anyway, as to how readily suffering and death has you reflect on your own life and practice. So the Buddha first says there's four kinds of horses, four kinds of, he says, excellent thoroughbred horses. The first kind is the one that picks up on their master's wishes with just seeing the shadow of the whip. And the second one has to feel it on his skin. The third one has to feel it in their flesh. It gets a little bit gory here. And the last one has to feel it in their bone before he understands what to do. And then people are like that too, he says. And here's what he says. This is quoting from this sutta. There is the case where a certain excellent thoroughbred person hears. In that town or village over there, a man or woman is in pain or has died. He, the practitioner, is stirred and agitated by this. Stirred, he becomes appropriately resolute. Resolute, he both realizes with his body the highest truth, and having penetrated it with discernment, he sees. This type of excellent thoroughbred person, I tell you, is like the excellent thoroughbred horse who, on seeing the shadow of the whip, is stirred and agitated. Some excellent thoroughbred people are like this. And this is the first type of excellent thoroughbred person to be found existing in the world. Then he goes to the next kind of excellent thoroughbred person who isn't moved by hearing of death in another town, but actually seeing pain and death in their own town. Then they're moved to practice. And the next kind are those who are not moved by hearing or seeing, but by seeing a blood relative die or being in pain. And finally, there are those who are not moved to practice by either hearing or seeing or having a blood relative in pain or die, but only by their own sickness or pain or a life-threatening circumstance. It reminds me very much of this John Donne, quote, who says, "Ask not for whom the bell tolls for thee." How well do you hear that bell? Or how well do you understand, what that bell means? How long does what does it take for you or to send you into kind of self-reflection about that and to send you into practice? Some hear the bell when it's, far away and understand what it means. And some are harder of hearing, I think. And it takes ringing right here to realize that we have to deal with this predicament. So I want to be that first horse, the one in the shadow of the whip. And I have to admit, I kind of want everybody to, when they just hear about death or pain, to have that inspire one to get to the bottom of things. But interestingly, the Buddha doesn't actually say here that the person who sees the shadow of the whip is the best one. He calls all four of them excellent thoroughbred people. Some get it on hearing of pain and death, and some it actually takes a closer event. And both Robert Aiken Roshi, in his commentary on this koan, and Shunro Suzuki, in his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, comment on this shadow of the whip story and say roughly the same thing. It's tempting to think that the finest horse is the best horse. The quick-witted one. But both of them say, don't assume that. Sometimes, it's the slow one that gets it down deep. It may well be that Ananda had a deeper realization because it took him longer. Sometimes being hard of hearing like Ananda was helps. Suzuki Roshi says, those who find great difficulty in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. You will have to work harder at it. And sometimes he says the worst horse is the best one and the best one is the worst one. We don't know what happened to that non-Buddhist. He just disappears into the, into the ether. Did he keep practicing? Or was he satisfied with that realization? I hope he kept practicing despite his quickness. I think this story of the four horses does point to a fundamental truth, and a truth that is bigger than Buddhism. And, it It points to what the question is, what do we learn from suffering and death? When we hear of it, when we experience it in some way, do we just want to alleviate it and get rid of it? That's not a terrible thing to want to do. Do we also in some, does it also in some way signal for us that it's time to reflect on our own condition and the human condition? Do we hear that bell? Unlike in the Buddha's day, we get, you know, turn on the television, look on the internet, we get news of pain and death in foreign lands, in other towns, all the time. And to be sure, you know, sometimes we are stirred and agitated by it, I suppose. It breaks through sometimes. But do we become, as the Buddha said, resolute to find with our body the highest truth and to follow through and see that truth? Does it lead to spiritual practice, that news, or not? And when we have a death in the Sangha or in our family, does that help us along our spiritual path? I think, by the way, the story of the four horses mirrors the Buddha's own experience. He saw old age, he saw sickness, he saw death, famously, when he left the palace. And it stirred him, it agitated him to get on the path. So it's, you know, that what that story tells us is it is good to be stirred and agitated by death, by pain. I think it's also good to try to alleviate that in our lives and in our families' lives and in the life in the world. Giving money to a cause or trying to alleviate poverty, for instance. But that is not what the Buddha did. That was not his response. He reflected on his own situation and he committed to a life of practice to get to the bottom of it. And he did that in order to help himself, but also to help everybody. Because pain and death are part of everybody's experience. Everybody's. It was a famous story of the woman who comes to the Buddha who's lost a child. And he asks her to go around the village and collect mustard seed from everybody whose house has not seen death. And so she does that. She comes back, of course, empty-handed. But in the meantime, she talks to every house about death, about the deaths that they've had. They share stories. She understands she's not alone. He did this to help himself and everyone deal with the inevitability of loss and death. And I think he succeeded in that. And I think it's a great thing that he did. Because we all do have to deal with this in some way. I think my feeling about the path is, yes, we have to learn to do both things, to alleviate pain and death, you know, as best we can, to help the world, and also to learn how to deal with those inevitabilities as well, and not be afraid of them. So my own reading of the Buddha's road to awakening is that in order to live with the inevitability of death, he had to learn to die himself. And he tried that first by trying a bunch of ascetic practices and controlling his breathing and almost basically starving himself to death. He was a skeleton. And in one story, he just lay there dead everybody thought he was dead, and all the deities call his mother, who died when he was a week old. She comes and mourns his death and cries and wails. And that revives him and sets him on a different path, one where he abandons his austerities, his kind of coming down to coming close to death by physically coming close, dying as close as he can. And he just eats some oatmeal and sits under the tree, the Bodhi tree, and relaxes some. And there, I think he discovers death in a different way. He learns to die there under the Bodhi tree. And that's the death that we are called to do every day. The death of our wordy, thinking, planning, worrying self. And the Buddha learned to do it under that tree. He learned that that was a natural part of himself. That aspect of himself in which his normal everyday self had died. That in fact, that uncovered what we now call Buddha nature. Which is this sense that everything is okay. That you can't get to unless you die. So we're called to die every day in this practice, and then come back, just like the Buddha did, die and come back to life. And thereby, in some way, have a different relationship with loss, with the deaths in our life. In Zen, we say, learn to die before you die. So all that brings us back to the koan, and I think what is the heart of this koan. I do not ask about words. I do not ask about no words. And the Buddha just sat there. And the Buddha's answer, I think, and most commentators point to, by answering that way, he's saying the way transcends both speaking and not speaking. It's beyond the distinctions of words or no words. So I just use the word transcend and beyond. Those words can be kind of tricky in my view. And something I learned in training is that when opposites are transcended, like words and no words, that means they include both. It's not that they that those two are out of the universe. They include both. It's a good thing to remember when you hear the word transcended. So the Buddha is at peace with both the world of words and the world of no words. Both life and death. There's this great big Buddha that sits in Nara. There's a few big Buddhas. There's also one in, what's the beautiful one that is like this? It's Kamakura? Yeah. These great grand Buddhas. And I was taught when I was training that the great Buddha of Nara, the largest bronze Buddha in the world, is so big because he includes everything. He includes all opposites, sound and silence, light and dark, self and no self, life and death, form and emptiness. That is a big Buddha. And this including both words and no words is for me not just a philosophical point. The philosopher, the non-Buddhist got it, but it's an important point for our practice, because I think we have to be reminded and we have to remember that in our practice life, we should not avoid either one of those things. That we shouldn't be afraid of either words or no words. That we have to learn to include both. in our practice life, it is very possible to get tangled up in, I mean, okay, not to mention the wider world, get tangled up in words and think that the world of words and concepts is the only world. But even in practice too, within a sangha, we can get tangled up in words, in philosophies, Buddhist philosophy, in social life, even in sangha life, and miss committee life, and miss the most fundamental point, which is to lose yourself, to learn to lose yourself, to learn to die. We all have to remember that that is fundamental to our practice. Now, don't just go stepping off the committee just for that. The point is, we have to learn to embrace and understand both, and not just get so tightly wound into human life that we forget to do the other. I had to learn that, you know, as when I was head monk. All about the business. Go and sit. Take time off from that and remember the fundamental point. I think of that as being captured by life, stuck in life. But it's also possible to get ensnared by no words in this practice, you know, enchanted by silence, and feel that just doing zazen all the time will solve everything, that is the way. And that, to me, is being captured by death and not being big enough to include both. This Buddha just sat there peacefully. He didn't speak, he didn't speak. That's true. But he's not trying to say that no words is the way. It doesn't say he remained silent, that he remained silent. It just says he sat there. He had both speech and silence. He was that big. Yeah, well, excellent thoroughbred people. I do hope that when you hear the bell, when you hear distress or death, that you are filled with empathy, that you feel that down to your bone, and that it leads you to practice. The practice of getting to know the realm of life and death, of words and no words, and that practice helps you to grow larger and larger.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.